said, the September 11th fund was a generous, more than generous, acknowledgement of our loss, that there will be an equal Afghanistan fund from the American people and from our government to help those people.
Rita Lasar and Masouda Soltan, speaking in Democracy Now! Studios in January of 2002. Rita died in 2017. She lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz in the World Trade Center attack. She would become an active member of the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Masouda Soltan was born in Kandahar, Afghanistan. She lost 19 members of her family in a U.S. bombing raid in Afghanistan soon after the U.S. attacked in October 2001. She would later write her memoir, My War at Home. Reporters packed into our little studio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 a.m. I'm Althea from The Gap. Our show is off today, but in its place, I hope you'll enjoy this special episode of Transpositive, hosted by KBOO's own Emma Lugo. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we are talking with Hillary House. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns. And we're here with Hillary. Hillary, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Hillary House and I use she and her pronouns too.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. So Hillary, the reason that we were inviting you on Transpositive was because I think a lot of people would really be interested in hearing your story and the kind of advocacy work that you do. On Transpositive, we always do a whole series of shows every year on faith and spirituality. So Hillary, we're really excited to have you on Transpositive today. And, I think it's really, you have a really interesting story to share that a lot of people may not think is a story that trans folks have. I would love it if you would first tell us, who you are and maybe a little bit about what you do.
So, sure, I'm happy to. I am a native Californian that is now living in Maryland. And I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I am currently, I think because of COVID in particular, retired from the, and I'll put air quotes around that, from the event industry, because COVID wiped us out completely. I was designing large galas and award shows. And that is, so that was my identity for quite a while. And with COVID, that all shut down. Some of it's restarting, but it's pretty tough still with Delta variant coming up. We're having some of the events that have been rescheduled since May of 2020 get canceled again in their new scheduling. So I, after, you know, trying to take that the company I was at into the virtual event world, I finally and found it completely different and not really a comfortable place to fit. I decided to retire, and I've hit 66, so I started collecting my first Social Security check, and so now I teach sailing, which is a joy for me, and I am a yacht broker, which is sometimes fun and sometimes not.
How fun. Oh. One of our other regular contributors to Transpositive, Jean, I know really enjoys sailing too. And, you know, it's interesting hearing your story because a lot of trans folks tend to get involved in service industry work and in places mm-hmm. where they can work for themselves. Mm-hmm. Because I think for many transgender people, they find that they really... you know, they really do well working in an environment where they have some control over how their gender expression is understood and, you know, accepted and tolerated. And it seems like a lot of transgender people do really well running their own businesses. But unfortunately, because of COVID, that might be an area that, like your story, maybe a lot of people who... our trans have been running their own businesses have really been hit hard.
Well, I just act like I own the business, actually. So I have owned my own businesses. But in particular, I started my life in show business. So I was a set and light designer. And when my daughter was born, that was too much travel for me. So I wanted to do something a little closer to home. My sister-in-law said, you got to get into this. This is like printing money. And I opened a video store back when those were brand new.
Like Blockbuster.
Yeah. A tinier version of Blockbuster back when independent stores. So I managed to, I had a small chain of about three of those and sold them before Blockbuster took over and long before Netflix put Blockbuster out of business and went into the 1 hour photo business.
Oh, no. There's one Blockbuster left in America, and it's right here in Oregon.
It's in
Bend, Oregon. And it's actually an Airbnb and a Blockbuster.
That is a fabulous combination. Yeah. As things started to wane in the video world, I brought in ice cream. And so we had that to rest on as well. And I ended up selling it to a woman who ran bakeries before that. So I think my video store is also kind of transitioned into something else.
Video and ice cream.
Yeah. So I went from that into 1 hour photo businesses and managed to sell that before digital put them out of business.
I remember those. They used to have mm-hmm. those like Kodak photo carts like in the yep. parking lots of strip malls.
Yeah. I had mm-hmm. one of those and then two other you know, full locations where we did portraits as well as processed the film. And I transitioned at that time. I owned my own business when I transitioned. So at the Photoshop. Great. And so I was a portrait photographer and 1 hour photo shop owner. And it was, you know, I didn't have a HR office to go to and talk mm-hmm. this through. So I found my the local chamber of commerce leader. I said, look, here's what's going to happen. What do you think, you know, I should do to, you know, work it out with the business community? And she said, I had been going slow. Okay, I guess we're moving into my coming out story here. I, you know, this was in the early 90s that I started to figure out that something was going on, that the cross-dressing that I'd been doing all my life had some kind of basis in it. And so at the time, I joined a transgender group in San Francisco. And I think before we actually had that name coined back in the 90s. And so I started doing public speaking back then because then we were looking to educate college classes. We knew that that message needed to get to high schools, but at that point we knew there was no opportunity to talk to kids at that age. So we were going to college classes, and so as part of that speakers bureau, we would usually have a panel, and in that panel we would have somebody who related as a transsexual, as a crossdresser, and, you know, pardon me that, you know, these are outdated terms now, but that, you know, that was where we were in the last century.
And, you know, some people still use those terms. I think that it's completely appropriate to like claim whatever term you feel is appropriate to identify yourself.
Right. And so, you know, I related as a crossdresser at that point. I'd been married for years, and I conceptualized it as this hobby, you know? And as I listened to the stories of the transsexuals who would talk about it, I started to realize, oh, wait a minute, you know, that's actually who I am. And I started to realize that, you know, transition would be necessary. So I went slow.
That must have been really challenging. That must have been like taking a lot of courage back in the 90s. I mean, there were some models back in the 90s, but it was still, yeah, you know, tough to do.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't know about it. We didn't understand it the way we do now. You know, it wasn't clear actually until I was doing it that that's what I was doing. One of my goals was to preserve my marriage. And so we said back then, and it's very misguided, so don't anybody take this idea now, okay? Is that maybe I could just, you know, dress a little more femininely. I could incorporate some of my feminine qualities into my masculine persona, because I was always effeminate as a guy. And so I started to do that, and I kind of walked the line. So long before there was anybody related as gender neutral, or we had a term like bi-gendered, or without pronouns or anything like that, I was walking that line, and literally people had no idea what pronoun to use for me. And I spent about a year there, and it's very uncomfortable for me, very uncomfortable for everyone around mm-hmm. me, because I'm actually a very feminine woman, down to it. So ultimately the realization came that I needed a transition. And so I did in my own business.
How did your wife respond?
So, you know, she was confused and desperate and upset back then. And I think her biggest struggle was the idea that people would believe that she was a lesbian, and she wasn't. So mm-hmm. I felt this kind of painful dynamic that in order to express who I was, I cast doubt onto who she was. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until we found the right therapist who said, well, it's clear that you love each other. You just have to realize that anybody can be, you know, anybody can make up a story about two women they see together and decide that they're lesbian or something like that.
Right. Yeah, totally. You know, I do that all the time.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's a lot of fun, right? And it doesn't make it so.
Like in a very positive, like wishing way.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish they were lesbian.
Oh my God, could she be lesbian? Mm-hmm. So it was, in a way, that realization that, you know, what our relationship was ours alone. And so we got to a point where we kind of got zen with it. And, you know, it was, I won't say it was easy, and it took time, and we had to make lots of mistakes along the way. But ultimately, it really worked for us. We've been married 43 years now.
Oh, congratulations.
Which is a long time for anybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that we've survived gender transition is, you know, one of those aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And she is.
And I always tell people, you know, everybody changes. Like exactly. When you get together with someone,
yep.
They're not going to be the same person in 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years. Everybody changes. Well, if nothing else, we just get older and fatter. You yeah. know, that's always a big, I mean, some
that's
of us.
That's a big change.
That's a big change. Right. Yeah, yeah. My wife always tells me, well, I can barely put my arms around you anymore.
Long relationships, you know, have a number of different relationships within them. They just happen to be between the same two people. And so that's true. You know, we've gone through all of them. You know, a whole raft of relationships. And yeah, none of us have the body that we started with. I mean, if we both look like we did when we were 22, wow. It doesn't work like that.
No.
So, and she is actually, you know, a big factor in why I'm Catholic. Because I kind of married into it. She is a cradle Catholic. Her father had spent 12 years in the seminary, and he was not ordained at the end of it. And so he got married and continued to challenge his kids and so on in the ideas of Catholicism. And so she is a very much a thinking Catholic. She has the Jesuit education from her father, and, you know, her own 12 years of Catholic schools and so on. Solid Catholic. We got married in the church. I have absolutely no background in any religion. My parents were pretty agnostic. And so I did, you know, attend church with her from time to time, and allowed my daughter to be raised Catholic. It didn't really make any sense to me until after transition. I didn't have any access to emotions until after I started taking hormones. And I think that emotional sensitivity is a crucial part of a spiritual process.
that's a great interlude. If we could, I'd like to introduce another co-host of Transpositive who's just joined us, and that's Sheila. Sheila, would you like to introduce yourself?
Okay, well, my name is Sheila Mengert, and I am a transgender person. Pronouns are since I'm an older transgender person, pronouns were never our issues, but she and hers will work just fine for today. And
thank you.
Well, the thing that I noticed mostly in my own life is that I did my transition in the pretty much the 1980s, and this was a time when there was no internet, there was almost no name recognition for the transsexual phenomenon, and it was called transsexualism in those days, as opposed to cross-dressing and drag queens. We had kind of three categories of people who were gender divergent. So much of the nomenclature that we have today has happened since I came out. And when I came out in a profoundly hostile environment where we had no rights, where violence, as it still is today in some quarters, it was a daily reality, where talk shows were the only vehicle for visibility, and these themselves were exploitive and treated us as though we were this there for sensationalistic value. And I've spoken many times about this, that they would have a whole stage full of transgender people, and the host would hear from each of them telling their personal stories, which were in many cases tragic. And then at the end, after our commercial break, we'll be talking to psychologist so-and-so so that we can understand what's really going on here, as if they hadn't already heard out of our own mouths what was going on there. So we were not only not recognized as having a valid identity, but we had to have a cisgender psychologist finally say, well, now that we've looked at these rare parrots squawking in the jungle, now we can finally hear, for us everyday people, what transgender is all about. So this is the world I come out of, and the book that I wrote was called Transsexualism and Its Discontents. And the concept of why are we discontented is we're discontented because our lives are being made untenable by various structures in our society that wreaks great harm to us personally and constantly takes away our dignity as human beings. So I felt this was a significant issue for all people, not just transgender people. So I wanted to hit some of the topics in a very brief and staccato fashion to awaken people to what our experience is as it's actually lived. Now, the problem that I see today is that now we have multiple allies that are saying, well, we're on your side and we understand you and you're mainstream now and you're on the internet. But the problem is we're still the same tiny minority. We're still comparatively economically and politically powerless. And yet we are being attacked from all sides because of our supposed transgender ideology, which is going to be under the people that are most fearful of us. They say it's going to be taught to our schools. Everyone's going to want to become transgender, and it's going to tear down our whole society, and these powerful transgender people are forcing it down our throats, and they want to compete on our sports teams, and we have to save American womanhood from all this terrible transgender stuff going on. And meanwhile, we're just ourselves and our tiny little lives that we're trying to make work. And I get very upset about this. So now when we go into religion, unfortunately, religion has become kind of shanghaied itself into saying, well, are you for or against this phenomenon? Do you want to stand behind it and undercut things? And so now we are taking a 2,000-year-old ingrained institution with its own methodologies and theology, and we're trying to take our personal, which is often very personal experience, and go head on head with a giant institution like the Catholic Church. And what about people like myself that have, in a sense, we've got a horse in both races. I'm both Catholic and transgender, and I've always been out in my church. I've been out in the community, and I was out on the streets when all the only people that were what we would call street trannies were really, they were the drag queens, and they were the people that I kind of grew up in. And now that I'm turning into the stage of being a granny tranny, which is my old time way of looking at myself, and now of course we're very careful about terms like we don't like tranny and we don't want to be too cute because we're fighting again the battle of words. And what I hope we can discuss today is how do we interface with various imperatives. Transgender protocol of what's proper to consider people's feelings, laid against a world that oftentimes is not even at transgender 101. They're not only not willing to fine tune their pronouns, they think that it's really a battle about words. And my thought, and I put this in my book, is we're not talking about words here. We're talking about human lives. We're talking about people found dead, transgender prostitutes and people like this. We don't get the luxury to sit there and sit in a nice university classroom and debate things as though it didn't affect us in our everyday life. And so I always want us to never get too far away from our experience as transgender people and what that means to us and the deep tragedy, and I think unnecessary tragedy, of wasted lives. So that's where I'm coming
Thank
from.
Thank you. Today. Thank you, Sheila. Thank you. So as you can tell, Hillary, Sheila is a lawyer.
Oh.
And
well, that didn't
a very good, a very prolific writer as well. And Sheila has just got the most well thought out words. I'm always so happy to have Sheila on the show. Hillary,
you know, I might want to just contrast, you know,
please.
Yeah, because only 10 years later, or, you know, 15 or whatever, 1995, but in Marin County, which is a liberal stronghold, my transition was, you know, much more, was kind of easy, really. It was really a matter of people seemed ready for me to transition, that people supported it. I got a lot of support from community, from I had a huge support group in what's now known as Transgender SF. I had support from a lot of different directions, and so for me it was a and you know, I'm relatively wealthy, right? So middle class, but you know, I started, you know, hormones, going to the same doctor that saw the street girls, and it was, you know, so we got to know each other as we went in for injections and so on. And they, many of them were part of Transgender SF as well. So I saw that I had the opportunity, because of the privilege that I had, to be able to work for those who had less privilege. And so I was involved back, you know, politically in San Francisco when we got the first transgender rights bills through in the city. Continued in California, and in 2000 when I moved to Maryland, I worked with the federal government for a long time to try to get them to move some along, and worked with,
which we finally just got last year, all that work. We finally got it last year.
We can't celebrate yet. There's still more that we gotta do, but yeah, we can celebrate the wins. But Gender Rights Maryland is an organization that I came onto the board of, and we were instrumental in getting gender rights in the Maryland area. And so I've led a life of privilege, I have to say. There's no doubt about it. I was an effeminate man, and I guess I had the privilege of passing for gay in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then, you know, after transition, I passed well, you know, and so it's a coming out each time I, you know, go to do something political or statement, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your coming out story. And Sheila, thank you so much for sharing yours too. Now, if we could, I'd like to move the rest of the conversation for the show into the topic of today's show, which is about transgender identities and Catholicism, and more broadly speaking about faith traditions. I think that, you know, we all have like our past that we come from, and we also have like our communities that we interact with and engage with. And I think that, you know, first of all, I think that there were a lot of issues that Sheila raised that are just so relevant and they're so salient to this conversation. And I also, but Sheila, before we get back to you, I just would like Hillary to have a chance to tell us a little bit about the work that you do with your website, which is called, is it Trans Catholic or Trans Catholicism or something like that?
Trans Catholic, yep. We make it easy on people. So yeah, that work, interestingly enough, I saw that there was a need for a kind of mainstream approach that always kept the positive aspects of being Catholic within the boundaries, I guess. So I had done some work for Dignity, which is seen as kind of outside the Catholic Church, but it's an LGBT group, and for New Ways Ministry, and which, you know, was started by a priest and a nun, and so it seemed a little more inside, but they've been you know, marked as being LGBT friendly and therefore outside, and I saw that there needed to be something that dealt not with the entire range of LGBT, because there are some true homophobia in the church, and the teaching on that is clear, not good, but clear. But among the transgender issues, there is no specific teaching by the church right now. So we fit into this kind of gray zone where there's a you know, interpretation by different people and at various levels of the church that marginalize us, and yet there is no specific teaching that precludes us from being transgender. And so it's I wanted to get that message out, and it's found a place, particularly for the parents that may not originally be accepting of trans kids. And it gives them an opportunity to see that there is a place for transgender people within the Catholic Church. And that is something that is critical. It's also been the place that Catholic school administrators can get information that shows them a path to accepting transgender students. That's not an area that gets a lot of attention, because when they do the right thing, they kind of keep it under the radar because they'll get attacked by the conservative parts of the church. So we provide that, we provide a place for that kind of information to get out there, the supportive things for transgender people, It's not something really for transgender people for the most part, because most of them have been so harmed by the Catholic Church that they run just about anywhere. There's a very few that remain in the church, and many like me who remain in the church simply to try to change it. My feeling is it's just such a big organization that it's not going to go away. So we got to try.
And neither are we. And we'll just keep on coming up generation after generation.
We've been around longer, you know?
Sheila, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, this is very interesting, and it's true. We have right now a window of opportunity, and this gets very technically Catholic, but for people outside the church, the idea of Catholicism is a little bit vague, because the question is, who gets to be the right to speak for the church? And the answer to that is that the church has a very carefully developed superstructure of institutions. Now, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, it used to be called the Holy Office in the old days of the Inquisition, is in charge of speaking on doctrinal matters. So far, there isn't anything that I'm aware of out of the Doctrine of the Faith congregation addressing it specifically. So that gives us room. There is another congregation that deals with Catholic education that came out with a document about 2 years ago. And when I read it, I said, I wish they were talking more to us, because there are certain misnomers there. It tried to adopt a compassionate tone with that, and the burden of the document seemed to say, we have to be careful in our teaching in Catholic schools not to go to the other side and say that we approve or have normalized transgender behavior, because they see it as a behavior, not as an orientation, and they're afraid of muddying the waters. So they said, we're adopting a more prudent course to say that transgender people are on the wrong track, essentially, but without really backing up that assertion. So on a prudential judgment basis, I could say, well, if that's how you want to run your schools, until there's more clarity on various issues that you can fit in, that's fine. But it was very scary for me, because I said, this is opening up the door to, sooner or later, under sheer political pressure, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is bound to come up with something. And unless they do some bigger studies and have gone a little deeper into what's actually going on in transgender science and medicine, they could have easily come up with something that says, well, we're just going to say what St. Thomas Aquinas would have said in the 1200s, and this is the way it's going to be. And I'm dreading that, because that'll force me to a question of conscience that otherwise I can kind of fudge it a little bit. It's sort of like if the Supreme Court in the United States hasn't weighed in on an issue yet, there's still room for advocating divergent policies and divergent ideas. And that what's the real problem is that, again, at the parish and the existential level where most of us live, most of us are not in today's society particularly caught up in deep philosophical questions or in interpreting texts. Well, when let's say the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith came out with a document, how authoritative is that? It's being decided at one of the highest levels possible. Now, does the Pope have control over everything? Let's say Pope Francis says something that sounds very gentle to transgender people. Is that an authoritative statement from him? No, it's not. Until he embodies it in an encyclical or something official, it's not church teaching, even though it came out of the Pope's mouth. So what that's saying is that in order to properly understand any text, and that's how, after all, in a big institution, things are reduced to a narrative, has to be reduced to actual words and on a document. And then that itself, if its reasoning is flawed, could theologians would come to bear and say, well, you've got some false empirical assumptions here, and we've got to correct those. But we're not there yet. So what is that saying to us as people that are transgender and Catholic? We're in a dynamic situation where the church itself is looking at many things that they assumed for many years and are saying, is this really valid? I mean, issues are being raised faster than the church can deal with them, and this is only one of them. And the result is that we're hitting a moving target when we're trying to find out where the church is on certain things. Now, certain ideas about natural law, that human beings are one of two sexes and that each sex has a designated order to play in marriage and which marriages can be, all of that, they would say, well, that's been settled for years. That's not even up for grabs. So the problem with a transgender person isn't just being transgender. It's, well, how are you going to enact that? Are you going to try to marry a person of which sex? And will the church recognize that marriage? And will it recognize the type of sexual activity you're engaging in within the marriage? And so there's, and they would say, well, those things are already settled because we've got a template on all those teachings. And so trying to fit what you're going to do out of your trans, what, I'm a celibate transsexual, so this is how I solve it. I don't sleep with either sex, so I don't have any problems via sexual activity. Well, that's not true for many transgender people who would still like to remain Catholic. So some questions I can't answer, and I have to acknowledge, especially as an individual, I don't speak for the Catholic Church. I can only speak for myself. But see how complicated it gets immediately.
Sheila, I'd like to ask Hillary a question, if that's all right. Hillary, there was something Sheila just brought up that was really interesting to me, and I was wondering if you could also maybe address it. How does somebody who identifies as Catholic and transgender kind of move forward within the Catholic Church? I mean, what do you offer to those people, and what kind of conversation do you have with such a person?
Well, I know legalistically there is the church doctrine to look at, but there's also the teachings of Catholic social justice, which really require Catholicism and anybody who's Catholic to support the marginalized. And I think that a number of people have come out, priests and bishops, and pointed out how important it is to support transgender people. And I think that it's a case where it is where they have, you know, where theology or the documentation of the hierarchy of the church is well behind the curve of both the society and science. And that document that came out about this, you know, for the schools, underlined that radically. It was clearly, to the extent that they suggested that it was about discussion, that they were raising questions that should be discussed, they did it in a way that was not discussive, and it precluded discussion, and it was formed without any discussion. They never talked to a single transgender person. The folks that I talk with, and I should point out that, you know, I'm not in a standard Catholic parish. I am in an intentional Eucharistic community. And it was formed as
identified. Is that one of those hippie churches?
Well, yeah, it might be. And so it in Vatican II, there was an idea to make the church open the windows of the church and spread it out into the vernacular so that so Mass would be held in English and people would be able to understand what's going on. And one of the ideas that came out of it was this idea of an institution, of an intentional Eucharistic community that would exist as an alternative to parish life. And so what happened in the area I live is that there was a hippie liberal area and they got a radically conservative priest assigned to them, and the people walked out of the church and they created their own intentional Eucharistic community. And one of the things that they do differently than your average mass is that besides it being in English and having readers that are, you know, are women and transgender people and divorced women, they also have a shared homily. And and so instead of just the priest talking about what the message is, each person can bring up their own ideas about what the readings meant to them. And it was in that situation that I got, that it finally came through to me that this is what Catholicism is about, what the real meaning of each of the aspects of the social teachings and of the what we were hearing each Sunday actually made sense. And so it was in that I was baptized 8 years after I transitioned. And so because I'd never been baptized before, it wasn't a problem for me. One of the laws is that you can't change your baptism. If you've been baptized in one gender, that's the gender you stay. And so I was baptized as female. And so I'm accepted in the church as a female. It's difficult for anyone else who has been baptized in the church to, get that changed.
Very interesting. So, Sheila, what do you think about that? That, you know, the history of the Catholic Church includes many different kinds of Catholicisms. I mean, just when you look at the actual history of the Catholic Church, you know, there was the Roman Catholic Church, and then there was the split, and there was the Byzantine Church. And that was like by the time things were actually institutionalized. And if you look at the history of Christianity going way back to like the first, second, third century, there were actually a lot of different kind of competing visions of what the Christian church was going to become. And so maybe one of the things Hillary is arguing is that there's a way to do Catholicism that's different from a papal encyclical, that maybe there's another way to do it that's kind of more bottom up.
Okay, well, the answer to that question from a problem that you would probably receive from a your average Catholic bishop would be to say that with a billion Catholics in the world, it's impossible for the church to police every individual parish, every individual priest, and every any little offshoot community. The problem is when we're dealing with Catholicism, transgender people are located obviously around the entire world, and the chance of finding a under-policed parish where they can find the type of a level of acceptance that I was just hearing is probably not available to them. So the problem is that, and I look at my life in this past year with COVID, I've been dodging around Washington, Oregon, and living in different places. I have to go to the parish that happens to be in my tiny little coastal community. And might I have a very understanding and gentle priest who would be very nice with me and would not frown at seeing me? Absolutely. But would I present myself for communion if I feel that there's issues that I haven't resolved? I wouldn't do it. But that's my own prudential judgment. But what I'm suggesting is that the church is a centralized body, and it's not possible to think your way around the church and around its history and around its jurisprudence without doing a type of violence to the institution itself. I've always taken the position that the church has a right to set its own table, which means it has a right to define itself, and I have to dialogue with that and fit myself in as best I can, and yet at the same time not to storm the ramparts and adopt my own position on things. So this is a very delicate balancing act. I urge people to engage in that balancing act, because I would, last thing I want to do today is to discourage people from being Catholic if they, and at the same time I want to honor the fact of the difficulties of the transgender, what I call the transgender imperative, which it hits people in different ways. We speak about the defining factor being gender dysphoria, which is simply a fancy way of saying I'm not happy in my gender roles. But what aspects pinch more strongly? Some people, it's a matter of face. I don't like this boy face I'm seeing looking back at me in the mirror. Sometimes it's a sense of, well, I'd like to be able to go out and get employment, or I'd like to simply be a stay-at-home housewife in the old 50s fashion. What options existentially are available to me? And everyone's going to experience that differently. So the balance that the church has tried to reach is they condemn anything that harms transgender people directly through direct harmful cruelty or discrimination, but at the same time, without being fully enunciated, as we've spoken of already, they say that, so it's primarily towards gay people, they say we refuse to recognize homosexual relationships as being valid. We refuse to recognize homosexual activity being a valid expression of human sexuality. But if you beat up a gay person, you've been very, very bad, and that's equally condemned. Well, the problem is that some of the teachings imply that that gay people, for instance, are doing something that they see as sinful, and therefore people that come after us don't sit there and engage in this little mental calculus and say, well, just how much can I condemn this person before I get frustrated with them and want to punch them out? And there's the problem. Is so the church is trying to have his cake and eat it too. And what I would like to suggest sometimes to various church authorities is say, you can't condemn things with vehement language and say this is very bad behavior, and not at the same time have a bleed over to people saying, well, since they're doing very bad things, they must be very bad people. And to say, well, no, they're very good people. God loves them. But on the other hand, they're doing very, very wicked things. Well, how do people in the real world balance those two distinctions? There's the question. Yeah.
Do you have anything that you'd like to say in response to what Sheila was saying? Otherwise, I might ask another question.
Well, yeah, actually, you know, it does seem counterintuitive. Most people, particularly those outside the Catholic Church, think that it is a monolith and that it all comes down from the top. But the reality is very different. The differences that you see might surprise you. What has happened is that because of Catholic social teaching, Catholics are the most accepting of the mainline churches of transgender people. It's been shown in the Williams study and so on that that we are, and yet we have a hierarchy that is the opposite. It's the least supportive. The reality is that there is a misogyny to the Catholic Church that just can't be denied. You know, women aren't allowed to serve as priests, and it is that is the heart of their problem with transgender people. And I think that if that were not the case, then we would be that tiny less than a 1% that are just, they're marginalized people, and they would come to our aid, you know, much more solidly. But as it is, we become this football in this social, battle that between left and right, between conservative and liberal. And we're just this liberal idea that's been shoved on people. What I have to say over and over again is that we have existed throughout time. We have existed in every culture. We have been integrated into religion after religion after religion. There is no reason why, Catholicism is the only religion that has transgender saints. You know, we celebrate Joan of Arc. She'll be my patron saint for a trans Catholic for some time to come, because ultimately that's what's going on there. And I think that we have to remember that there are parts of the church like the Catholic hospitals, Catholic Health Association, that has shown that we should not be discriminating against transgender people. There are a surprising number of parishes out there that are supportive, but you just never know. And that can be a very hard thing for transgender people. That has helped out Zoom this year in church, has been helpful, I think, for a lot of transgender people that, you know, can check into a group that is maybe farther away, but works out better for them, that they can attend a mass by an order as opposed to an archdiocese, and they'll find more acceptance among Jesuits or Franciscans. That's the kind of thing that we're seeing within the church, is that the church has these different orders as well. And it's a wide, wide spectrum of Catholicism that exists.
Thank you. I think you have the last word, Hillary, because we are just out of time. But before we close, I would just like to make sure that each of you has a chance. Sheila, I'd like it if you could share your book and how people can reach you. And Hillary, I'd love it if you could share your website again and how people can find that.
My transgender book is reached through Kitsap Publishing in Kitsap County, Washington, and that's the best way to access my book. And the Apocalypse Now book won't appear until 2022. I have a book of short stories out right now. That's through Blue Forge Press, and I have it's an anthology, but there's also a solo volume for each of us. I think that probably the best way to reach that is to just look up the Trinity Anthology, which is up on Amazon, and it has the monthly editions, the seasonal ones, and if you use my name, you would get at the individual volumes, but I expect that under Blue Forge Press, everything would come up. I did want to say one last thing on this idea of what transgender people have to contribute to any faith community. We're good people, and many of us have know concretely what it's like to suffer and make a great sacrifice for personal integrity and to try to sustain our relationships at the same time. So I'm in complete agreement with what Hillary is saying here.
Thank you so much, Sheila. And Hillary, if people would like to find out more about the website that you're an admin of, where can they find that?
Sure, transcatholic.org It's not a .com. It's not monetized in any way. It's a Roman Catholic apostolate that supports the dignity and inclusion of transgender laity. So you'll find articles by priests, by lay people, all of them focused on the positive story of transgender people within the Catholic Church. There's also a Facebook group, so Trans Catholic, check us out there. We're not very good on Twitter or Instagram, but if you find us on Facebook, it's a pretty lively group in there.
Great, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure having you, Hillary, and it's always a pleasure having you, Sheila. Thank you so much for joining us today on Transpositive.
So great to meet
you. Welcome.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to stop recording.
Hi, Jean.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
What is that terrible racket?
It's Radio Lost and Found on every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mulla Gaita Siroh to the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. The Old Mole Variety Hour is pleased to offer a large print of your choice of Betty's most iconic photos to 10 lucky donors during KBOO's fall membership drive.